Well, I'm going to zoom back out to an ecosystem scale. I'm interested in ecosystem budgets and in calcium weathering rates, or calcium supply from soils, calculated by different methods. And the closest I'll get to biological weathering is the effect of whole tree or clear cutting on weathering rates. Don gave us an introduction to Hubbard Brook. Good for input-output budgets because there's a series of small headwater catchments instrumented to measure streamwater outputs, precipitation inputs, and then whole watershed manipulation. So we can look at the effect of things like clear cutting on input-output budgets. I started working at Hubbard Brook with the whole tree harvest of Watershed 5 in 1983. And one of the interesting questions is, where are the nutrients going to come from to regrow the watershed? So it makes a big difference to sustainability of forest harvesting if weathering is going to supply that or if we're depleting soil stores. My assignment was to do phosphorus budgets for the undisturbed Watershed 6, the recently cut Watershed 5. And the main thing I want you to notice about this is that there are no error estimates with any of these pools or fluxes. So, it frustrated me for a long time that I didn't know how to do that. This is a 2005 publication showing the amount of calcium coming out of the mineral soil in young stands, so less than 30 years old, or older stands, greater than 30 years old, accounting for streamwater export, precipitation input, and the fact that the forest floor is accumulating, the vegetation is accumulating in these younger stands, they're getting like three times as much calcium out of the mineral soil as the older stands are, still no error bars. So my goal right now is to address two different ways of estimating this rates of calcium supply and to put uncertainty on both of those. So first I'll talk about the net hydrologic flux, meaning the input-output budgets for Hubbard Brook. Hubbard Brook's been doing this for a long time, the input-output budgets, and they never have uncertainty with them. We do have replicate watersheds, but we don't replicate the whole tree harvest experiment. We cut one when we cut one. So how are we going to assign uncertainty to that net calcium export from the watershed? Here's what it looks like. So the net flux is negative, meaning precip minus stream flow. There's more coming out in streams than there is going in. I think Don addressed this. And prior to this experimental clear cut, the control, which is red, looks the same as the clear cut in blue. And then there's a huge calcium loss immediately after cutting associated with the nitrate pulse when trees aren't taking up ammonium and gets nitrified. That's not surprising. What was surprising was that the calcium export from that young regrowing forest remained high and remains high to this day. Well, are those different or not? So now we start wishing we had some way to put confidence limits on that estimate. So what we're going to do is try to identify all the sources of uncertainty that come into this. There's natural variability. I'll tell you right now, year-to-year variation is higher than our wet years versus dry years makes a big difference. And the problems we have with knowledge uncertainty are actually small compared to that. Every type of measurement error that comes into these calculations, the models that we use, the choice of models that we use, we're going to try to quantify all of those. John Campbell did this analysis. This is the list of sources included, undercatch of a rain gauge. What about gaps in our data? What kind of uncertainties does that introduce? Chemical analysis obviously comes into both of these. And then we do spatial interpolation for precipitation. We do temporal interpolation for stream water. So he did a Monte Carlo. And for each of these sources of uncertainty, you sample from a possible distribution of values and do that 10,000 times and then look at the distribution of the outputs. The improvement. Initially, we were doing that with normal distributions, and we don't know. In fact, sometimes we know that they're not normally distributed. So the analysis that I'll show you is based on real distributions of uncertainties, and in the form of cumulative frequency diagrams. So that red line is what a cumulative frequency diagram looks like for a normal distribution. You're going to see some weird looking cumulative frequencies. So, for example, interpolation of precipitation. Anybody use Thiessen polygons? I was embarrassed about this. This is what you could do in 1950 by hand. Every point on the watershed is represented by the nearest collector. So you have a weighted average for the collectors that describe any of these watersheds. It turns out it doesn't make much difference. So nowadays, you just push a button in GIS, you could do inverse distance weighting. You could do kriging. Oh, these colors aren't very good. Oh yeah, there we go, spline. So you can see if you're far from the watersheds, it makes a difference what method you use. But right in the watersheds, it doesn't make much difference because the rain gauge network is so tight. So in fact, if you compare those five different models for interpolation, it makes less than a percent difference in the annual precipitation input. So we sample from those five possible models for each of our watersheds when we do the Monte Carlo. Equal chance of hitting any one of those five options. I won't go through all the sources. Watershed area was one that I didn't think of as being part of my calculation. But the stream, you have to divide by the watershed area. We just always use the same watershed area. We use the one that was surveyed in 1955. Okay, so here we compare that to the topographic divide identified by a digital elevation model. And there's two choices for watershed 5 and watershed 6, and we're going to randomly sample one of those two every time we go through the 10,000 estimates. Gaps in the data. Craig is here. Craig's working on this problem. So this was ice comes crashing down the stream and destroys the heater system. It took 3 weeks to repair. This is an unusually long gap. What Craig and Mark Green did, what do you do when there's a gap? You fill it based on nearby streams. There's a really nice relationship. This is tighter than it looks because there's 1.5 million points on there. There's a nice relationship, regression relationship, so you can fill a gap that way. The way to estimate the error introduced by that is to create fake gaps, where you could use the real method for filling the gap, and then you can compare the predicted to the observed, because it was a fake gap. And they did that stratified by the length of the gap and by the flow rate at which the gap occurred. So then we sample from that. This is the uncertainty due to gaps for the period of record where the gaps were recorded. And this is what the distribution looks like of uncertainty due to gaps in runoff. So these are all the distributions of uncertainties that we used. Uncertainty in the chemical analysis applies to both precipitation on the left, streams on the right. John did this not just 10,000 times, but 10,000 times for each of the sources. So this is really nice. If you know which are the big sources of uncertainty, you could do something about it. Our biggest one is, bird poop in the rain gauge. We have 25 gauges for volume and 2 for chemistry, so it wouldn't be hard to do more than 2 for chemistry. It says that the stage discharge relationship is really good, but it was only calibrated at very low flow. So now we're interested in doing some calibrations at high flow, and I expect that to become a bigger source. So the answer is net hydrologic flux. Now we have error bars. So the prior to the clear cut, we have green dots, and the net hydrologic flux of calcium is about 7 kilograms per hectare per year, uncertainty of about 0.5 kilogram per hectare per year. And then if you look at the post-harvest, we now have error bars, and the greater production of calcium from those soils somehow, I can't say it's weathering, I can say it's denudation, is about 3 kilograms per hectare per year. Okay, so that was the input-output budget approach. The other approach is to look at soil profiles and to look at the calcium concentrations relative to an immobile element, in this case titanium. This was done by Schaller and Bloom and others using 13 sites. So now we're going to be able to use replication. We have 13 sites where we dug quantitative soil pits. We dug 3 quantitative soil pits at each site. Of those 39 pits, 9 were rejected. I understand that's a pretty modest rejection rate for this type of work. There are many disturbed profiles where you couldn't subtract one from the other, and they do get some negative weathering rates from the ones that they accepted. It turned out the presence of the E-horizon was not a great indicator. Strength of the E-horizon wasn't a great indicator of how disturbed these profiles would be chemically. So what we're hoping for is an example like on the left-hand side. This is from site C2, which we like very much. So various elements, the bottom panel is calcium for the 3 pits. So it's very well behaved. The assumption is the sea horizon tells us the original condition. So as calcium is removed from and other elements are removed by weathering, the concentration of titanium goes up. So the answers are weathering rates, and these are the mill equivalents per meter squared per year I was just trying to convert. So they do vary somewhat from pit to pit and from site to site. There wasn't a pattern with withstand age. This is a much lower rate. So instead of 7, we're looking at 0.5 kilogram of calcium per hectare per year. There are assumptions, and I didn't talk about the uncertainty in those assumptions involved in using these methods, but I think it's clear that the rate of supply we're seeing now from the mineral soil is much higher, given both sets of error bars, than the long-term rate calculated over 10,000 years of soil development. So I may not have answered any questions about mechanisms of biological weathering. I hope I've piqued your interest in uncertainty analysis. So some of you have already been involved with QEST. Quantifying Uncertainty in Ecosystem Studies is a research coordination network. We have a website. You can send us papers. You can send Craig at quantifyinguncertainty@gmail.com papers that we should post, code that we could share. You can find stuff like that. You can write papers. We'll support your open access publication. And Craig says that he'll wait until Friday to analyze the results of the survey if you want to contribute. And right now we have 26 answers in the soils area out of 130 altogether. So we'd like to see some more soils responses. We're asking about sources of error, what types you include. If you use other types of data sets, you can tell us about those. What do you do when you have values below detection? How do you decide when you can use a data point or not? So if you go to the website and scroll down to a tweet from August 30th, you can do it right now while I answer your questions. Yes, Dan.
This is not a question about Quest, but coming back to the original treatment on Hover Brook on your disturbed watershed, you said the calcium was driven by nitrate. And what is it driven by today?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. My favorite hypothesis is that.
What's the measurement?
Oh, you mean what's the balancing anion?
Yes.
Gene Likens asked that too. It must be DOC.
Yeah, okay. That's
does somebody here know? Wait, where's Don? Don, do you know? Yeah. Lindsay, somebody. Yeah. All right, so can I say what I want to...
Yes, please.
What I want to hypothesize is that... So I have this chip on my shoulder about phosphorus versus nitrogen, having started out with the phosphorus budget for my PhD. If the young forest is more phosphorus limited, given all this excess of nitrogen, and biologically accelerating the weathering of appetite, then there'd be some extra calcium around. So we're doing stuff. Joel Bloom and Melanie Fisk have buried some appetite cores in understand the different ages in which we have nitrogen-phosphorus additions to see if we can see that there's enhanced weathering of apatite when the forest is more phosphorus limited. Yes?
How do you deal with the uncertainty for changes in the reference life over time? I mean, it's a 25-year period, presumably the pretreatment relationship has changed over 25 years.
So John's analysis pertains to both. So what he's doing is saying, how confident are we of these export estimates for the reference watershed? How confident are we of the estimates for the treated watershed? And they're more different than they are uncertain. I'm not sure that answers your question.
Okay, so what if the reference is changing in terms of demand?
It is changing.
Then you calculate the difference in terms of the net export relative to what's occurring in the reference.
It is changing, and so we're comparing them side by side. I mean, this is one way to compare them side by side, is graph one versus the other. So there's wet years and dry years. That's huge natural variation, but they tend to be synchronized. And the other way to look at that is with time on the x-axis. Oops. Yeah, there.
It's the paired watershed approach.
No, I get that.
Yeah.
The paired watershed inherently assumes that the relationship pre-treatment would have, in other words, if you hadn't cut, those lines post-treatment should remain the same, right?
Yeah.
But presumably the demand and the cutting and what's occurring within the reference band, the stands change, the composition change, right? The nutrients.
Yeah, you remain subject to the problems of having an unreplicated experiment. So if the ice storm affected one of these more than the other or something like that, we'd be screwed. We don't know. I'm actually impressed at how similar the watersheds are one to the next. They're very, very tight. So interannually, we have a lot of variability, natural variability, but the watersheds 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, they behave really similarly. Compared to Coweta, that was in that paper you were on.
Right, well that's
Coweta has more variability from one stream to another.
You don't have a control, you have a reference, and it changes over time.
But the question I'm asking, how do you count that?
Look at the change over time of the reference.
You have to arm wave, because there's not a statistical basis. This is, where's Dale? Is Dale Johnson? Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday. People complain about the lack of replication of the treatment of a whole watershed.
Yeah.
And what do? You just give up and say, well, it's all pseudo-replication. I quit.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy. I'm happy that we can do that. We can put some confidence intervals on a measurement from one watershed. Kent.
So just a clarification. Did you say that the hydrologically based rate was about 10 times the soil loss?
Yeah, and I thought our soil loss base rate was about 10 times low compared to what you said it should be.
Okay. Yeah, we can check it out.
I may have gotten my units wrong. Darlene.
In some ways, this is a very valid point, talking about the reference versus the treatment one. And if you can come back with something mechanistic that you can actually specifically assess within the treatment and the reference, then you actually may be able to get some assessment of that variability by looking at a mechanistic approach or process.
Our arm waving has negative connotations. Let's say interpretation. And then it's not the only experiment like this, right? So the more you look at them and the more you see similar patterns, then that builds your confidence too in your interpretation. I'm sorry, I should step down. We have general discussion. Thank you.